Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Grand Lake St. Mary's in western Ohio is the state's largest inland lake. It's a state park that for years has been a popular tourist destination, but farm runoff has polluted the waters. Now there's an algae bloom that's the worst in the lake's history. Tourism is drying up, and some local people are irritated by what they believe is inaction by state officials. WOSU's Sam Hendren visited Grand Lake St. Mary's a few weeks ago. Let's hear a segment of his report.
At a boat ramp near State Park headquarters, Jim Kohler is winching his 21-foot sailboat Obsession onto a trailer.
Okay.
The thick green algae in Grand Lake St. Mary's is so bad, he wants to protect the boat's paint from being stained.
Okay. What do you think?
Well, I think it needs a good power washing. That's what I think. But I'm going to go wash it and go set in dry dock for a few weeks.
Dozens of other boats sit in slips at the marina, floating on a thick green mat of algae. Rebecca and Joe Herzog say they've been vacationing at the lake for 20 years, and they've never seen anything like this.
I'm just taking a picture of the algae. It's really sad.
Pretty bad. Up the road there at the beach, it's all nothing but green. It's horrible.
I took a stick, a piece of a stick, and I scraped it, and it just is like sludge. It's just nasty.
The waves washing ashore look more like green latex paint than lake water. Plus, there's the overwhelming odor of dying algae that blows through the almost empty campgrounds and into the cities of Salina and St. Mary's.
Joining us later, professor of environmental and development economics and another professor of biological sciences and a representative of the Lake Improvement Association at Grand Lake St. Mary's and also a representative of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. Right now, we'll get caught up on the latest news about the lake with Columbus Dispatch political reporter Mark Niket. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, Ann. Good morning.
The governor had a press conference on Friday. What happened?
Yes, he went to the lake, and he had four of his cabinet directors with him, and he announced sort of a short-term and a long-term plan for dealing with the problem. And the short-term is to do sort of a test on the about 20 to 40 acres of the lake. And just to back up, they're sort of addressing two problems here. They call it internal and external loading. Mm-hmm. You have the problem with the phosphorus that's already in the lake, the internal loading. And then you have the problem with the external loading of additional phosphorus being put in the lake. So to deal with the internal loading, the phosphorus that's already in the lake, they're going to do a test on this 20 to 40-acre section of the lake. They call it an alum treatment to essentially treat the phosphorus and try and neutralize it. And then if that is feasible, if that works out, they're going to do maybe a whole lake application. The problem there is the short term is going to take place in the next month or two, but the full lake treatment would be about $5 to $10 million, which apparently there's not a funding source for that right now. But then they're also going to do sort of a longer term plan to address the runoff from the farms, the external loading component of this, to try and reduce the amount of additional phosphorus that'll go into the lake in the future.
Is there any sense that some kind of inaction by the state has brought us to this point with Grand Lake St. Mary's?
Well, as I understand it, there is some complaints or concerns from residents that this has been a long-term problem, that only now we're seeing action because of the extent of the problem or how bad it's gotten. I don't know how fair it is to say more could have been done in the past. I think part of what we're dealing with now is it's as bad as apparently anybody's ever seen it there, and is demanding the kind of action it's getting.
And there are other lakes in the state that have the same kind of problems.
Right. I'm not that familiar with the science of this, but apparently this toxic algae problem is not isolated to Grand Lake St. Mary's. We're seeing even in Lake Michigan and the other Great Lakes, this kind of problem developing in other inland lakes as well. So part of this, I think, is just over time, as we've seen the effects of particularly agricultural manure runoff into bodies of water, combined perhaps with high temperatures this year and other factors.
The state actions for water quality improvement at Grand Lake St. Mary's, is there any sense that this could be applied to the state, or is it just focused on this one this one geographic area?
Well, I think they're going to focus it for now on Grand Lake St. Mary's, but clearly if this alum treatment works, I think it's something that could be a blueprint for, you know, use in other areas where you have the same kind of problem. Again, I'm no scientist, and maybe your guests will get into this, you know, later in the
That's
show.
That's why I invited a few.
Good call there. Apparently, there's some trick to, you want to neutralize the phosphorus, but you don't want to create, an acidity problem or some other effect that could, you know, be its own problem and kill fish and whatnot. So apparently there is some trick to, you know, finding a treatment that can neutralize your problem without creating a bigger problem.
My guest is Mark Niquette of the Columbus Dispatch. We are talking about Grand Lake St. Mary's. It straddles the border of Mercer and Auglaize counties. It's Ohio's largest inland lake, and it's a toxic mess right here at the height of the tourist season. Now, Mark, the Dispatch reported this weekend that the state will spend nearly $8 million this year to improve, promote, and stock its lakes with sport fish. But just $15,800 in state money to test bacteria levels at beaches and $80,000 in federal and state money to test water in about 10 inland lakes this year. Who sets these priorities?
Well, that's maybe one area where you could criticize the state for not doing more, because it's clearly just not a priority either within the Ohio Department of Natural Resources budget or other agencies where you might be funding this kind of testing. As you pointed out, it's just a paltry amount of money spent on testing to determine whether, you know, you have toxins with this algae. And, even to just do more study to have a better idea of, you know, what's happening in these lakes. Clearly it's just not been a priority for the state to allocate money there.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you'd like to speak with Mark Niquette, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Now, the agency that oversees this kind of pollution in agricultural pollution, it's not the Ohio EPA necessarily, is it? Is it the Ohio Department of Agriculture now, or how does that work?
Well, I think it cuts across a number of different agencies, which is why you had the cabinet directors with the governor at this press conference Friday at the lake. I mean, I think you have some components where the Ohio EPA would be responsible for monitoring pollution, what's going on. ODNR clearly is involved because of this is a state park there, and they would have some jurisdiction there. And of course, you have the agriculture department involved because of what's happening with the farmers and what I think most people would acknowledge to be one of the biggest problems here. The reasons for the problem is the runoff from the farmland that's getting into the lake. And then, of course, you have the Ohio Department of Health, which would be involved because of the health concerns that have emerged. They've had instances of people getting sick and even pets dying, apparently, have been exposed to the toxins in the water. So it cuts across a number of different areas in state government.
Have they established that the pet deaths and the illnesses are directly related to the toxic algae?
That's a good question. I don't know if it's been definitively proven that that's the issue or that's the case, but I think that's the clear suspicion because of, contact that the pets and people had with the lake and, sort of ruling out what else might be involved. I think that's the clear suspicion. It's the lake problem.
Now, what are potential political ramifications of this? We're, just jumping into the talk about top of the season of politics come Labor Day. What about that?
Well, it's clearly an issue. It's a big election year. Governor Strickland's up for re-election, and you can't be seen as not doing anything about it. It's clearly a big problem, and a lot of people are affected by it. This is a big recreation area, Grand Lake St. Mary's. And the residents around there are just furious, apparently, about it. I haven't done a lot of reporting on this myself, but even the story we had on Saturday about this press conference where the governor announced these plans, we quoted the owner, I think, of a campground there saying, "This is just jabber, jabber, jabber." People not happy with what they see as even this response, that it's not enough. And I think you see the importance of this in the treatment it is getting. Politically, I think the governor's sensitive to what this could mean. The U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was in town last month as part of a. He made several stops around the state, including Columbus, and ostensibly there he was there to promote different programs within agriculture. But they took time to specifically address this issue at Grand Lake St. Mary's. In fact, the secretary made two promises. One, that any kind of technical resources the U.S. Department of Agriculture had would be made available to state officials and local officials there to deal with the problem. But also he came sort of with a check in hand. He promised another additional $1 million in funding for a federal program called the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which, again, is part of the long-term effort to help decrease the amount of particularly farm runoff that is contributing to the problem.
We have a message from Liz on Facebook. She writes, "It is clear that the problem originates from all the manure and fertilizer runoff from farms in the county. Why not hold the farmers accountable for the cleanup, or the state or federal departments of agriculture? And since we know this is the cause, what are we doing to change our ag policy to fix it? Seems like a great example of why factory farms suck and why we need to be returning to a more organic and humane way of farming." Now, we're going to get into the state actions in a lot more detail with some real scientists, Mark, so fear not. But I am wondering, the agriculture community is an important constituency as well in Ohio.
Right, exactly. And you can't, you want to, again, fix the problem, solve the problem without creating other problems. Mm-hmm. And, you can, certainly there's efforts that's already been underway, and I'm sure you'll get into this, to restrict the amount of phosphorus that's, being put into the lake through the runoff by methods for storing manure and application of pesticides and so forth. But you can't restrict the ability of the farmers to get the kind of yields they need and their operations as well. So there is a tricky balance here, and that's why I think some of these programs, while they may sound good, I think the problem some people might have with them, or at least the frustration people are going to have, is it's a longer term deal, like this, Environmental Quality Incentive Program, the EQIP, that the Agriculture Secretary is providing additional funding for. It's already been in place for a while, and essentially it pays farmers to, restrict the amount of manure that they use to, again, reduce the amount of phosphorus. But it's a long-term deal. It's not something that's going to sort of fix the problem overnight.
This has been going on that where people have been sitting up and taking notice this year about a month now. And I haven't seen, I might be missing it, but I haven't seen Governor Strickland's opponent in the general election, John Kasich, make much of an issue or at all an issue out of this.
No, I have not seen that either. Okay. In fact, I've not heard him even address the topic. That doesn't mean he hasn't and won't, but you're right. He has not made a big point in the political campaign.
Okay. Well, Mark, that's all the time we have. Thanks again. Mark Niket, Columbus Dispatch reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
When we return, we will be meeting David Culver. He's an OSU biological sciences professor emeritus, and he can answer some of these technical questions that are rolling in. So if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Do it there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Got dinner table discussion, water cooler chat, even pillow talk, but how often are you part of the national conversation? I'm Neil Conan. Raise your voice on everything from the news of the day to the twists and turns of culture and history on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. 77 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 88. Clear skies tonight and a low of 70 degrees.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on WOSU comes from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher education faculty who are working for great public schools for every child. Online at OHEA.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us now is David Culver. He's an OSU professor emeritus of biological sciences. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much.
Also, Tim Lovett, he's president of the Lake Improvement Association for Grand Lake St. Mary's. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you, and good morning.
Governor Ted Strickland says state and local officials are trying to figure out the best tactic to fight this threat.
There is no roadmap to follow here. This is a very unique situation. We are conferring with EPA directors from many other states. We're trying to identify every expert that we can to seek advice and guidance as to what we should be doing.
David, is it really a unique situation? I've heard that things like this are happening all over the state.
Actually, it's broader than that. Blooms of these cyanobacteria, or often called blue-green algae, occur all over the world. I've studied this in Australia and China and most recently at Lake Erie. So these are big problems, all related to nutrient input.
So it's not unique, and it's not even new, is it? It's been going on for a long time at Grand Lake St. Mary's.
Yes, that's correct. One of the things that's bothered people the most is that analyses of the amounts of toxins in the lake were very, very high, many times the World Health Organization's criteria. And that's one of the things that's required people to close for swimming and so forth.
Now, the problems with Grand Lake St. Mary's are not new. What made them so bad this year?
That's a good question. We have worked with the Department of Natural Resources Fish Hatchery, which is connected to Grand Lake St. Mary's, uses water from the lake to fill their ponds for many years. And there always has been high nutrients and algae coming from the lake into the hatchery ponds. But the last 2 years have been particularly bothersome with large blooms of blue-green algae and high toxin levels.
So the heat, there's more dumping?
I don't think it's a linear thing. I think it's more likely the case that, as the previous discussion suggested, we have inputs from outside the lake which add phosphorus to the lake, the external loading he mentioned. But there's also internal loading, and we have phosphorus that has deposited in the sediments over the years. And if the lake goes anoxic in the deep waters because of too much algae, that can be released. And probably there's quite a bit of evidence that middle of June, beginning of July, that happens the last 2 years, big amounts of phosphorus possibly coming from the sediments.
Tim Lovett, I want to hear from the governor again, so bear with me.
Let's see.
Governor Ted Strickland, he traveled to Western Ohio to Grand Lake St. Mary's along with the directors of the state departments of health, natural resources, and EPA to warn residents and tourists that the water is simply not safe now.
A lot of commerce depends upon the lake. I mean, there are small businesses around the lake that depend upon having access to the recreational use of the lake. And unfortunately, right now, that must be curtailed because our primary concern must be human health and safety.
Tim, what has the economic impact been there? Do you have any sense yet?
Yeah, we spent a fair amount of time talking to a lot of local businesses and people that are impacted by this. And it's been devastating. I mean, to the tune of a lot of instances, 50, 60, 70% of their business has not been realized this year. I mean, when you live on a lake and you depend for the people to come during the spring, summer to get the majority of your money, obviously it's going to be devastating when you got a lake that's closed down.
This has been coming on for a long time, though. I first started hearing about Grand Lake St. Mary's having problems with this mid-90s. Why haven't people been raising cane there long before it got to this tipping point?
You know, I can't answer that. I moved down here in 2005.
Okay.
And at that point in time, I knew the water was bad, but I also knew that there was talk of, you know, actually doing something to increase the quality of the water, make it better. And so I moved down with the intention of that happening, and unfortunately, as you well know, it's just continued to get worse and worse and worse to the point now where the lake is basically shut down.
When was the Lake Improvement Association formed?
I believe it was back in the 1940s. So it's
oh, really?
For, for quite a few years. Yes, it has been. Their focus then had been typically subsidize or help the High Department of Natural Resource and things of the nature along the lines of park improvement and those kinds of things, not really focused so much on the quality of the water as they are now.
The governor spoke a little bit about the costs associated with some of the fixes, and in a few minutes I'm going to jump into this, these state actions for water quality improvement with David Culver, but is the community prepared to pitch in for any of these costs?
Well, I mean, we already have, first of the year, around February, we started raising money. We raised over $500,000 to try a couple of what they call irrigators, which are oxygenation machines we put into the water. And we've also spent money to buy sediment collectors, which go into the streams. We purchased two of those. So the community has stepped up.
Mm-hmm.
And can they step up to the tune of what it's going to take to clean this lake up? I suspect not, that we're talking significant amounts of money.
Okay, let's take a phone call right now. If you'd like to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Murph, you're on the air. It sounds like you have a question for Dr. David Culver.
Well, I do.
Okay.
I'm a Buckeye, but I moved out west about almost 30 years ago. I'm back now. In Arizona, northern Arizona, they had the same problem, and it was directly related to some mining activities with runoff. Now, I don't know who the person is that you can contact. However, they came up with a fish that was something between a carp and a goldfish that ate the algae and became a game fish. I mean, for crying out loud, it's completely biological, and it became, it didn't happen overnight. It took them a couple of years, but they cleaned it up. Anybody looked into that?
I'm not familiar with that particular solution. There are organisms that eat algae. The scariest one that I can think of right now is the silver carp that we're desperately trying to keep out of the Great Lakes. So don't let anybody tell you that I said to get silver carp in Grand Lake St. Mary's. That is
not
the case. But it would have to be something that would be native and controllable. And that's the tough thing about biological solutions. That's
right.
One of the reasons why the use of methods to remove phosphorus input is one of those things that's tried and true and works.
Well, certainly the runoff has to be controlled. That's no mistake.
Yeah, we're going to be getting into that later with the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and others. So,
but as a short-term implement, it might be good to look into some native fish that might help to control the algae.
Okay.
Maybe they'll eat it.
Okay. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest, Tim Lovett, he is president of the Lake Improvement Association at Grand Lake St. Mary's. And also Tim Lovett, he's an OSU professor of biological sciences. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So let's go through a little bit, if we can, the state actions for water quality improvement. And Tim, I'm interested in your impressions of these suggestions as well and how they might affect the community. One thing, when they're talking about the internal loading and dealing with the algae and the phosphorus levels that already exist without the additional runoff, they talk about an alum treatment.
Yes, this has been used for many years in various places to varying success. The idea of alum is aluminum sulfate. It's used right here in the city of Columbus as part of water treatment for removing particulate matter in river water to get our drinking water clear. So this is a technique that basically forms a flock which settles down slowly and precipitates phosphate onto it, and it settles to the bottom. So this sounds like a great deal. The problem is that when you add aluminum sulfate to the water, it takes the hydroxyl ions out of the water, leaving the water acid. So the techniques that I've read about...
Not a good thing.
Well, the proposed treatments include adding a buffer that will help keep the pH at a normal range. So it's not as unsophisticated an approach as it used to be back in the 60s.
And they're also talking about just doing it as a pilot project, and they use this word quite a bit, in discrete areas. What do they mean by that, 20 to 40 acres?
Well, we've all seen the barriers that they put up to keep the oil off the shore to varying success. They will probably use curtains, floating top curtains, just like that, to shut off a cove or two and then be able to treat within that cove and see what happens to water quality and removal of phosphorus with that approach.
What about that, Tim? Is that something the community is willing to go with?
Well, I think at this point in time, I mean, when you've got a lake that's as toxic as what Grand Lake St. Mary's is, you have essentially no recreational value at all. We're kind of looking for anything that can at least, you know, in the short term, open the lake back up to recreation and all the things that we do down there. But at the end of the day, I think one of the things that kind of concerns a lot of us is that this treatment is fairly expensive. Mm-hmm. And if ultimately we go and we decide that our tests are effective, and we go ahead and we implement that into the lake, and you're talking about a 13,000-plus acre lake, mm-hmm. you know, I've heard to the tune of anywhere from $5 to $10 million. And if that's not effective, given the fact that that lake's fairly shallow, has a lot of rough fish, a lot of wave action, a lot of boating, so ultimately we could end up putting $5 to $10 million in a lake that ends up, you know, may work for a short time if it works at all. So that's the concern we have. And if that happens, you know, what are we going to do with our next movement?
Mike, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I've got a question as to the possibility of some sacred cows lurking about in this discussion, or at least in this problem. First of all, nutrients can come from a number of places. I heard manure mentioned once, mm-hmm. but I would think manure would release its nutrients more slowly than chemical fertilizers that are used on corn. And I wonder if the explosion and the amount of corn that's being raised in order to supply ethanol is a factor in this. And with all the rain we've had, the chemical fertilizers would wash out like sugar out of a bowl, I would think. And I wonder if we should be looking for solutions, at least partial solutions, in that area. And I'll take my answer off the phone.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Dr. Culver?
It's certainly the case that inorganic phosphorus fertilizers are applied in the watershed, and those, particularly if they're not dug into the soil but are surface applied. And unfortunately, one of the approaches that's used is to put those down when the ground is frozen so that people run big trucks over and sprinkle these onto the ground in the wintertime. Obviously, that phosphorus has a very low efficiency of incorporation, and runoff could be a big problem there.
Tim, tell me a little bit about the relationship of the community with the farms in the area over this.
Well, I think, you know, the area is specifically agriculture. It's
right.
Not a real high populated area.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the runoff that we're talking about is farms that lay due south of the lake. So, the farms to the north are typically not an issue with that. The relationship has been somewhat strained, as you can imagine. It's also been it's been a good relationship for a lot of years, but unfortunately it's got to the point now where there's a lot of people that are hurting, you know, purely from a standpoint of financial, and a lot of lost property values was all that we were going to reflect on the school and property taxes here in the not-too-distant future when they come back and reassess taxes. So there's a lot of things that are going on, and part of the problem is now is that we've got a lot of people pointing fingers and blaming, and somehow we got to figure out how to get past that, and we got to get to the point of where we actually start making some headway to fix this thing. And it's a bit strained, I would say, at this point in time.
Has anybody from the agricultural community stepped up? I mean, have they grouped, you know, created any kind of group locally to talk about this and represent themselves?
Well, they have various groups, and okay. I want to make it perfectly clear that this is not an all or nothing type of thing. There are a lot of producers out in the watershed that do good things.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done the right things for years. Unfortunately, there's not enough of them. We're looking at an agricultural business that has probably three times the amount of cows that that ground, or excuse me, animals, I shouldn't say cows, mm-hmm. but three times the amount of animals that that ground can actually support. So we've got to come up with some way of saying that if we're going to continue to do this, then we've got to come up with better management practices of what we're going to do with that manure. I mean, you know, I think you probably heard that the statistic is of 85% of it's farm runoff. So
right.
Ultimately, we've got to figure out a way to do that. It becomes a math thing. I mean, if you've got three times the amount of animals that you have for ground, then we have to take a look at that and see how we can fix that.
All righty. Dr. Culver, is there a way to fix it?
Well, some of the solutions are a matter of better control of manure. For example, some people have suggested that any farm should have a large enough manure storage pond system, as many ponds as are required, so that they could store an entire year's worth of manure so that it could be applied to where and when the greatest amounts of phosphorus being controlled could occur. And obviously, that's not the case now, because someone was saying in the newspaper just this past week that they think that farms should be able to store at least 3 months' supply. Well, the months of January, February, and March come to mind. Is it the case that if it's raining like crazy that someone should still put manure out on a field? Obviously not.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this segment. Tim, I hope you'll join us again and keep us posted.
I certainly will. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And David Culver, OSU Professor Emeritus of Biological Sciences, thanks for your help today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Gazillion more questions to go, but we'll do that another day.
Thank you.
All right, we have to take a break. If you'd like to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We can be so closed in. And when you listen to WOSU, they address things from more than one point of view. It's a global point of view, and you realize that you are indeed a citizen of the world and not just a citizen of Columbus, Ohio. My name is Joyce Eubanks, and WOSU is my source for a worldview.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll talk about creative education for our children with author and educator Mimi Chenfeld. That discussion begins at 11. Thanks for joining us on WOSU. Be sure to get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to wosu.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And it's 77 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a warm day today with a high of 88. Clear skies tonight, a low of 70 degrees, mostly sunny for Tuesday and another hot day with a high of 92 expected for tomorrow. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me now, Larry Antosh. He is with the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. He is the Senior Director for Environmental Policy. Larry, welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you.
Also, Brent Songren. Is that how you pronounce your name, Brent?
That's fine. Songren.
Okay, Songren. Songren, OSU Professor of Agricultural, Environmental, and Developmental Economics. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Larry, phosphorus is the problem. It's caused by manure and fertilizers that wash off the farm fields. In Lake Erie, according to the Dispatch, it has created large oxygen-depleted dead zones. What are farmers already doing to reduce the amounts of phosphorus in their community rivers, streams, and lakes?
Well, Ann, there's been a lot of effort over the past 20, 30 years from the agricultural community in terms of addressing nutrient runoff and nutrient management. Up in Lake Erie, we're very, very successful in implementing conservation tillage practices, which kept the sediment and the nutrients on the land, kept it out of the waterways and getting into the Lake Erie. And we saw major, major improvements on that. Now, recently, about the mid-1990s, there's been a spike of dissolved phosphorus leaving the land surfaces. We don't know why.
Why that's
happening, mm-hmm. or why it's going on in Ohio.
Aren't there a lot more farms or bigger farms now?
No, not really.
Okay.
And as we move through and look at the practices that agriculture has been implementing and dealing with, developing nutrient management plans, putting in grass waterways and buffers, there's been a lot of programs and emphasis in doing that. So it's we really haven't been able to point our finger on what's happening.
Brent, you have proposed treating farm pollution like every other commodity and paying farmers not to use the nutrients that cause the pollution. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. I think one of the things that we would like to see sort of in the economic world is to try to incentivize farmers in a way that they have the right incentives to do, quote-unquote, the right thing. A lot of people talk about that. So in this case, it would be to reduce the amount of pollution coming off their farms. And one way to do that would be to basically just pay them to reduce that. So they put a certain amount of nitrogen on their farm, certain amount of phosphorus on their farm. So let's pay them to reduce that. They're going to take a yield hit. Someone mentioned earlier that, wow, farmers got to have yields. They've got to make money from mm-hmm. their farms. And absolutely, we agree with that. But the idea here is that there are some pollutants out there that it might be worth it for the rest of society to pay for them to reduce. And I think we can do that. I think we can figure out a way to commoditize the pollutants coming off their farms and pay them to reduce that.
Now, they do have programs that are aimed at reduction, but they fund machinery and technology.
That's right. That's right. I think Dr. Culver mentioned an interesting point about the manure pits, places to put manure and store manure. And that's interesting. Big manure pits do a lot of benefit in terms of reducing big spills, which kill fish on an immediate basis. But they don't do a lot about the management, which is the amount of stuff that goes on the landscape. Farmers who have enough of a pit, a big enough pit to store for a year, still have to put that stuff out on the field. And if they go out and put it on the field and it's not getting taken up by the crop, which apparently it isn't in all cases, then it's still a problem, even though they have a big pit to put it in. So my idea here is that basically we've got to talk about the management that farmers do and figure out a way to get the right incentive to the farmers to change their management of the manure, not so much how they store it or the technologies that they use to keep that stuff sequestered from the environment.
You said there ought to be a price, but what's your sense about whether we can afford that price?
I think we already are affording it. I mean, we're spending $85 million a year in Ohio on these farm programs to supposedly provide a better environment for us. Now, to some extent, they're working. In some places, we get better. We get better. We have more pheasants. We have more quail. We have more nice things floating on the top of the landscape. But we have worse water quality under some measures in some parts of the state. So these programs aren't working perfectly. And I think the money's there. We can just figure out a way to use them better.
Larry, what about the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation? What do they think about shifting the funds from investing in technology to outcomes?
Well, Ann, our programs, our policies are really geared towards looking at the proper management of nutrients. Our policies support the process of developing a nutrient management plan and implementing management practices and all that. And so it's a matter of a system approach rather than just a one-size-fits-all. I always like to talk about the fact that one reason why I personally do not care for regulations, is that the regulation tends to be a one-size-fits-all solution. We have a variety of landscapes across Ohio. We have a variety of agricultural commodities. We have a variety of farmers. And one solution that works in one situation may not be the best solution someplace else. So whatever flexibility that we have in terms of dealing with land management, dealing with nutrient management, would be the most favored approach.
One of our callers mentioned sacred cows. I think he was referring to chemical fertilizers, and that they should be – somehow we should be controlling the use of chemical fertilizers. Why do we have to use them so much? Do you think of them as sacred cows? What is the relationship there with the fertilizers and the yield, and if you controlled the use of them, how it would affect the yield?
Well, it all comes down to a balance. If you develop a nutrient management plan and nutrient balance, you are analyzing your soils, you're looking at realistic yield goals, and making sure that you have enough nutrients to grow the crops in the amounts that you would want to have. Sometimes you can do that with just manure. Other times you need to supplement it with the commercial fertilizer. The bigger question or the big issue is to making sure that you have the right amount applied in the right way to grow the amount, you know, the crop that you want to grow. So it's not a yes or no organic, inorganic, manure versus commercial fertilizer. It's how should all that be in balance so that we don't get out of flux.
Now, the state, through the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Division of Soil and Water Resources, is going to apparently seek to adopt rule revisions in the Agricultural Pollution Abatement Program that will allow the division and its local soil and water conservation district partners to expedite orders when pollution problems occur and timely volunteer cooperation cannot be achieved, which makes me wonder, well, are we eliminating the voluntary aspect of this and making it – do they want to make it mandatory?
Now, the rule change that our friends over at Department of Natural Resources are looking for really comes down to the fact that, as we know, our state resources, financial resources, are not very good. And we're seeing an impact of that at the local level with our soil and water conservation districts and the staffing that's out there. The rule revision that Department of Natural Resources is looking for is to be able to handle those situations where there may not be adequate staff in the field, adequate soil and water conservation district folks, and then things could move over in the state office or over here at Fountain Square rather than just moving through the soil and water district.
614-292-8513. And Carol, I wanted to take your call. It's a little bit off topic, but Dr. Culver is still here. So you're on the air, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Okay, thank you. Since I learned at Millersville University in Pennsylvania just last June that lawn owners use more fertilizer per acre than farmers do per acre on their crops, why aren't we also encouraging lawn owners to reduce the amount of fertilizer that they use instead of just blaming farmers?
Does that pose the same sort of problem when you look at it on an acre-by-acre basis, Dr. Culver?
I don't know the numbers. I would guess that the number of acres of lawn in the Grand Lake St. Mary's drainage area relative to agricultural farms is relatively small. But absolutely, there's almost never the case that any homeowner needs to put phosphorus fertilizer on their lawn. It's almost only nitrogen. And so that's another important way in which we can reduce the amount of runoff that would come down the gutters and into the storm drains and directly into the lake.
All right, Carol?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not guilty of this because I have a mowed meadow.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. 614-292-8513. We have an email now from John. He wonders, can any of your guests comment on whether or not this problem exists at Indian Lake?
Yes, this is Dave Culver. There have been problems at Indian Lake, and people have told me that 20 years ago, a group similar to what has been described by Tim has worked very hard at Indian Lake to decrease nutrient input. In that case, a lot of it was agriculture, but a lot of it also was from failed septic tank of sewage disposal for homes around the lake. And they definitely improved the water quality at Indian Lake. What I hear, though, is this summer, with the hot temperatures and rainfall in early spring, has increased the amounts of algae that they have, too. But their problems are still small relative to Grand Lake St. Mary's.
Larry, the state, in its state actions for water quality improvement, I'm sure you've seen it, one of the things they will seek to adopt is rules that restrict land application of manure in the winter and require non-permitted farms generating or using manure to do so only under an approved nutrient management program. Is this the sort of one-size-fit-all regulation that you're talking about?
In reality, what's being proposed mirrors very much what our policies support in terms of following existing standards and application for the wintertime application of manure. Now, a direct prohibition, given a certain time frame, I believe they're looking at December 15th through March 1st, that again requires, as we've talked about earlier, the need to have storage facilities so that you cannot, you're not land applying at that point in time. The big problem we run into is that Mother Nature gives us an experiment every year in that we never, you want to be able to go out and do the application if and when it's possible and necessary. The proposed rules do talk about exceptions. You have to have prior approval. So if the weather conditions are such that it's appropriate to land apply, the farmers can still go out and do that. It's following, making sure you have the proper setbacks and things on that nature. An outright ban is that one size fits all, and as long as we can provide some solutions, some opportunities for those producers that may not, be able to store manure, that's that time frame and all that are necessary in order for that to happen.
614-292-8513, or give us a call. Tom, you're on the phone. You're on the air.
No, I just wanted to ask you, why are you zeroing in on farmers? Why don't you look at the big picture? What happens to all the salt they put on the road? Farmers have a 100-yard buffer zone. You don't have a 100-yard buffer zone in the city. You build right out into the city. And the lady beat me to it on the lawns. How much fertilizer is put on lawns that runs off and contributes to it?
Well, it's pretty well agreed that of the large majority, about 85% or more of the runoff that's causing this problem is from agricultural runoff. Is there a dispute about that, Larry?
No. As you look at we start looking at watershed management, and the way I always describe watershed management is that the character of the watershed, the land uses in the watershed, have an influence on the water quality. In the case of Grand Lake St. Mary's, that particular watershed is primarily an agricultural watershed, so that land use, that activity, will have an influence on the water quality. The urban areas do have an influence also, and I would say that if you go to your local Lowe's or Home Depot and look at lawn fertilizers, Scott's company and others are manufacturing turf management products that are zero phosphorus. They've essentially come up with agreements, memorandum of understanding dealing in the Chesapeake Bay area, and they're doing the same thing nationally. So that issue is being looked at and being addressed, not to say that it's not part of the problem. Everyone that lives, works, visits, recreates in a watershed has an impact and an obligation to make a difference.
That help, Tom?
Thank you, and good luck to you.
Thanks. Brent, as long as you're talking about incentives, those are always going to be voluntary. And you were talking about the $85 million that's already going to subsidize technological improvements without expecting or requiring a specific outcome. Do you mean to end that and just shift the funds to incentives for outcomes? If the outcome becomes more difficult, I mean, it could be very expensive. How do you know what is going to be profitable enough for the farmers to participate?
I think that's a really good question. So, you know, one issue is, do I mean to take that entire $85 million and switch it over to a different set of programs? And I think the answer there is no from my perspective. I think there are a lot of good things we get out of some of the money there, but we can shift a good chunk of it, target it better. I mean, we have problems like Grand Lake St. Mary's that do come up from, you know, we hope it doesn't come up too many times, but it does come up. And so let's target $25 million out of that. Let's get it over there. Let's set it up in a system whereby, you know, farmers, you know, maybe we do something a little more innovative than what we've thought about. We make a 5-year agreement. It's voluntary. You're going to get that $25 million. You solve the problem within the next 5 years. If you guys don't solve it in the next 5 years, then basically we're going to come in with some heavy-handed regulations. You're going to all sign off on it. Farm Bureau is going to sign off on it. It's what we do with other industries. We give them options to solve their problems voluntarily initially. If they don't solve them, then, and this is the chemical industry, et cetera, when they have big spills, well, they come back with heavy-handed regulations later. So I think there's a lot of ways to be creative with respect to performance-based sort of pollution control. And so we can take that money and use it a lot more wisely than we use it now, and I think we'd be a lot more effective. I did also want to make one point about the question about wintertime nutrient applications and whether those rules would be pretty effective. And my guess is that they probably won't. And I think that's kind of the idea of a technology that probably won't work, because the issue is management. You know, if you're not putting it on in the winter, you're putting it on some other time. If the issue is too many nutrients,
it's got to go somewhere.
I mean, so we've got to deal with management.
Okay. Not enough time as usual. Thank you for joining me. Tim Lovett was with us earlier and had to take off. Brent Songin, OSU Professor of Agricultural and Environmental and Developmental Economics. Thanks for joining us, Brent.
Thank you.
Also, Larry Antosh, he is with the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. Thanks for being here, Larry.
Thank you.
And Dr. David Culver, OSU Biological Sciences Professor Emeritus. Thanks for staying with us.
I enjoyed it very much.
That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.